And now, Forward with Falk. Join Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen as they navigate their way through the political thicket. Well, Dave, here we are at a weekend where we have Passover, Easter, Ramadan all at once, something that doesn't happen more than, well, I don't know how often that happens, but not often. I suppose I could figure out some way to tie in our discussion of politics with some kind of lame joke about Passover, which if I can think of it, I will do. But the point is, we got the Pennsylvania primary in 4 weeks and 2 days.
Right.
But do you see any evidence of a political campaign?
Not much. What I'm seeing a lot of evidence of is the television stations making a lot of money. Yeah. But it's
but that's
not,
been going on all year. I mean, these Oz and McCormick, they've spent nearly $40 million on television ads. I think basically that's what they spent it on, television ads.
Yep, not organization.
No, neither one has any organization.
No, I remarked the last couple weeks about the dearth of signs that we don't see around, and I haven't seen a single sign for either Oz or McCormick on a lawn anywhere. I've seen two, maybe three signs for Dave White, he's running for governor, not for Senate, but I haven't seen anything on the Republican side in terms of Senate. And for that matter, I haven't seen either a Fetterman or a Lamb sign on the Democratic side for Senate, let alone a Kenyatta sign. It just, there just doesn't seem to be any ground game that any of these people are having. They just know how to spend money from the top. And the party leadership doesn't seem to be anywhere in terms of who or what they want. Although, at least in the governor's race, they seem to know who they don't want. But beyond that, it's very hard to tell. And we have these dark money groups that are putting funds in. And then, of course, this week we had Donald Trump decide to enter the fray, apparently against the wishes of a lot of the Republican leadership in Pennsylvania, jumping on the Oz bandwagon. And,
A bandwagon? I don't think there's a bandwagon. There may be a horse cart somewhere.
Yeah, I think that's a better description.
Donkey cart. I'd say donkey cart.
Donkey. Well, no, that's a Democrat cart. Donkeys.
I see.
But not much there. And no one could quite figure out the calculation there, except that it's celebrity. And Trump is drawn to celebrity because neither of these guys has been a true blue Republican in terms of who they've supported or policy that they've supported over time.
Neither was Trump before he became a Republican.
Yeah, I get. Yep. Yeah, details, you know.
Right.
And so that's the funny
but
part
it's
about
it's not surprising that on the Republican side there's no ground game because neither McCormick nor Oz is from Pennsylvania. They don't have any ties here. They don't have any organization here. In order to have an organization, it takes you at least some months, even if you're going to buy it all. It takes time to buy it all. But they haven't had that time. So to me, it's not a surprise that there's no ground game. Republican Party, as a party, has some sort of an infrastructure, but they're split. Here you have the Trump people supporting Oz, but McCormick has the top Trump people in his camp.
Yeah.
So what you have here is a complete organizational disarray. The top ideologue on the Trump team, Stephen Miller, is with McCormick. Hope Hicks is with McCormick. And Oz has Trump's support. Now, I mean, it's insane from their viewpoint.
Oh, yeah, and don't forget McCormick's married to Dina Powell, who was in the Trump,
That's
high
right.
up in the Trump administration.
That's right.
But it's, well, that's, you know, one of those things about politics. You know, Trump's been out there endorsing other candidates. He endorsed Herschel Walker. He endorsed this week J.D. Vance, who had said some really nasty things about him. I mean, J.D. Vance, the candidate, is about 180 degrees from J.D. Vance, the guy who wrote the book Hillbilly Elegy.
Yeah, but the guy who wrote Hillbilly Elegy is dead. The only one who's alive is the Trump, you know what.
Yeah, the Trumpist core that somehow emerged. This is all just opportunism. It's just opportunism.
But isn't all politics that's a hobby opportunism? I mean, yeah. There are two types of people in politics. One, because they're cause-oriented, and the other, because they're opportunists. So I'm not shocked that the guy is an opportunist. I'm not shocked that Oz is an opportunist or McCormick is an opportunist, because that's what they are. They look upon politics as a hobby or a private business. They're into what they feel like doing. These are not people who are, they're not democratic in the sense that they're trying to motivate masses of people to help make their own history. What they're motivated by is to mobilize masses to support their interest.
Yeah, I mean, these are just two multi-millionaires who have got bored at what they were doing and decided that we're going to do this. I don't know if you saw the statistics that came out of the article that came out about the millionaires in the Senate and in the Congress and how much they're all worth. It's incredible. These guys just want to have that on their, you know, in their background. But meanwhile, you know, Oz is a physician, and if you remember the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm. Certainly, he's doing harm in the primary, and he would do a lot of harm in the Senate. McCormick, you know, just another business-oriented guy who ruined the teacher's pension plan for the sake of his own profits.
The Pennsylvania teacher's pension plan.
Yeah, yeah. So it is, but also this is something that we're not dealing so much with overall, you know, policy to help people. The policies that they're talking about are all these social issue policies. You know, nobody will be teaching race theory when I'm there. Nobody will, you know, transgender people won't have rights. Women's won't have control of their bodies, that those kind of things. But broad support, things like the Affordable Care Act or something along those lines, none of that stuff is what they want to run on. And, of course, that mimics what happened in the election of 2020 when the Republican Party had no policy platform. And they still don't have a platform. For things.
What the Trump people have been able to do quite successfully, and actually this dates way back to the Newt Gingrich days, is make these local elections national elections, to having a national platform that they're all committed to and that they all run on, which the Democrats don't do. And Trump was the best at this because he jettisoned the platform and had a national hero that you should vote for. And everybody who runs on the Republican side runs as a flag waver for their hero. That's the campaign. And the what ties it together from the point of view of ideas is family values and what they call culture wars. I don't know why it should be called culture wars. These are political wars. But, you know, family values is their big thing, right? That's how they, under that, they stuff the anti-abortion movement. So,
well, the family values they're looking at is their misconception of what family was in 1958, that they saw on television, all white, no conflicts, nothing about minorities.
Well, also not working class. It's a middle class family.
Yeah, and of course the middle class has been devastated under their policies,
exactly,
starting with Reagan.
But nationally speaking, if you look at it from their viewpoint, nationally speaking, if you mm-hmm. take it from, you know, from that approach, how is it that there are so many leading Republicans who are credibly accused or have even agreed, confessed to the fact that they're wife beaters or adulterers? Is that part of family value? I grew up, I was taught that beating a woman was not right. But now it turns out it's part of family values. It shows the man's dominance, leadership of the family. That's what they're running on.
Well,
that's what they're running on for governor or senator in five states.
Yeah, Georgia with Herschel Walker. Like you mentioned, Eric Reitens is back after a hiatus in Missouri after he had to leave office.
He blames George Soros for the fact that it became public that he abused his wife.
Yeah.
But his wife was the one who got the order of protection against him, not George Soros.
Right. We have the guy in Nebraska.
Nebraska,
Who just came out this week, was groping women at will, which
state,
I guess...
State rep. Groping a state rep.
Yeah. I mean...
In the state house.
In the state house.
Well, I guess that's a family value. You do it in the house.
Well, we heard Trump talk about that during the campaign.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
It didn't seem to stop him. But that's the misogyny part of it. The sad part of the misogyny part is that there are enough women who are willing to go along with that, who are attracted to this kind of male domination idea. And I think a lot of that is religious-based, particularly down south, where that one wing of the Baptist Party says women's duty is to serve. And then you get these other things.
That's true of all fundamentalists. They all believe that.
Yeah.
And they all practice that.
Right. You have all these now anti-abortion laws that are being passed, where a woman is being forced to carry the baby of her rapist, even if it's her father or uncle or whatever it is. But of course, then once the baby's born, there's no support for the child from the Republicans. And perhaps even worse is that Tennessee law, where they've decided that there's no age for marriage. You know, it's sort of like the Taliban and ISIS.
Wait a minute, say that again?
There's no minimum age for marriage.
I can sell my 8-year-old daughter?
Yeah.
Of course, at 8 years old, she wouldn't be in a position to make a choice.
No, well.
So I could sell my 8-year-old daughter to some old guy, 15, for marriage?
Yeah,
in Tennessee.
So, Tennessee, yeah, that's the thing, you know. Like I said, at ISIS, you have these 30 and 40 year old, 50 year old men getting 12 year old brides out of the family, and this is now Tennessee. Of course, you know, remember, we're back to the Scopes era.
Yeah,
Tennessee's gone back to that kind of thing. They still win elections on these things. Part of it is, you know, because the Democrats have no are unable to mount a viable opposition to them.
What do you mean then, unable to mount it? I don't get it. Why are they unable to mount it? It seems that it's despicable. It's a despicable thought. How come people can't be made to realize that? Can't be brought to realize? Or why do they downplay something like that?
Well, that's part of it, is the selling of it. You know, and there was a... I think a telling quote that came out this week about unions and the problems the unions are having parallels in some ways, many ways, the problems that Democrats are having. And Sarah Nelson, who's the head of the flight attendants union, talking about how difficult organizing is. And she essentially said that the unions have spent all their time and their money lobbying in Washington, D.C., and not nearly enough in organizing. And part of organizing is handing out information and getting people to understand what their true interests are. And, you know, you and I have heard this from the trade unions up here in Scranton and Lackawanna County for a number of years ago, where the leadership is on one side and the membership is on totally on the other side, even though it's not in their interest.
But this business about the union leadership not organizing is a very old story. And it really dates from the passage of the Taft-Hartley Law in the late 1940s. The Taft-Hartley Law basically made it illegal for communists to be members, much less leaders, of trade unions. And the consequence of that was anybody who was a militant unionist could be called a communist. There was no way to defend yourself against such a charge. And end of story. So what happened was there rose a group of leaders within the unions, not devoted to organizing, but who saw their role in the way the politicians on the electoral field saw their role. They got themselves a job. It was their private business. They'd be the leaders of the union. They could be the leaders of these unions for decades, for the rest of their lives. And they all made good livings.
Yeah, well, and
the worst thing you could do would be to try to organize, because if you tried to organize, some hotshot would get rid of you because you weren't doing anything.
Yeah.
That's basically who's the leader today of these unions. Sarah Nelson is an anomaly, completely different. Well, when you do that, when you don't organize the rank and file, you have to rely on trying to lobby. You have to rely on the government and the courts to protect your members, because you don't have the strength yourself to do it. So what she's condemning is the whole history of wiping out militantism and getting rid of the militants from within the union movement. That's why the Amazon struggle, which won in Staten Island, was carried out not from within the retail, wholesale, and department store workers union, or within the Teamsters, who are traditionally the organizers of warehouses, but by a guy who got fired and was all by himself and organized his friend, and they organized three other people, and that's how they did it. Because they were outside the influence of these, what we would call business unionists. She's pointing to something that's not new, that's deeply impregnated within the American political system that dates from before the Taft-Hartley Law, but which really, in its current form, grows out of the Taft-Hartley Law. So,
yeah.
And of course, the Democratic Party and the electoral systems naturally suffer from that. There's a carryover, because what happens in society is reflected in the parties. The parties don't create social consciousness. They are reflections of social consciousness. But unions do create social consciousness. If you wipe them out, then you leave social consciousness creation in the hands of the Koch brothers and other corporate people.
Well, that's something else that needs to be talked about, as to who are the real stakeholders in terms of businesses, the large businesses. You know, we had that article, that position by Milton Friedman 50 years ago, that only the shareholders and profits are the business of large companies, and that nobody else, not the employees, not the customers, no one else has a share or stake in this. And that's what we're doing, is we're probably at the end point of all of this. We're starting to see, I think, a little bit of turnaround on that. But still, there's a long way to go. And there's all sorts of turmoil when you're trying to change things at this level. I think it's an inflection point. And we don't know if we're going to be able to make that turn. In a lot of places, so far they haven't been able to, and we'll have to see. You know, and we have these fights now that are coming on about Twitter, which is a communications meme, but they're talking about should Elon Musk take over. That's out of the frying pan into the fire, in my opinion. These business leaders are autocrats. They're not small D Democrats. It's nothing wrong with being profit driven. You need profits, but the way you do it and who you harm in that method and how much you make because you don't invest in things like safety or fair wages is another issue. And if you can't communicate those things to people because the new way of communicating is the social media, is the internet.
By the way, I have nothing against Milton Friedman's point of view that the job of the managers of a business is to maximize profits. I think he's probably right. I can't imagine a situation in which you can both maximize profits and be concerned with your workers' welfare. Because basically, you're sacrificing your workers' welfare in the interest of profit. That's when you don't implement safety rules in the factory, you maximize profit. That's one of the ways you do it. When you increase increase productivity by speeding up the amount that you have to get produced every day, whether it's at the computer or at the assembly line, that sacrifices workers' interests for profit. And it is the job of the managers to maximize profit. But that only points out that in a capitalist society, each interest group has to be organized for itself and has to be conscious that it has its own interests. And the ultimate result is the result of the clash of interests and the political negotiation that is made that comes to some resolution and is based on the strengths of each side. In the absence of a union movement, people say, well, there should be the managers should have the concern for the workers. And it's never going to happen. That's like asking a coroner to cure healthy people. That's not his training. His training is to find out why they died. Yeah. You need a union. It is a clash. There is a clash of interests, and each side needs to be organized.
Yeah, but there is a third party to this, and that's the role of government.
But even government is a negotiation between the interest groups, right?
Yeah, it is. But when there are certain things, there are certain rules that the government can come in on. For instance, they can create OSHA, which would help in terms of worker safety, set rules and regulations.
Yeah, but then if the Republicans control it or corporate interests control it, then OSHA is defanged. And now the Supreme Court will tell you that OSHA... Yeah. Doesn't can't properly have a role here, there, and elsewhere, right?
Right. Yeah, they say you can't make rules. It's only Congress can
only
make
Congress
rules.
Can make rules, right.
And, of course, that means no rules are going to get made.
So there you have it. Again, if the working class is not organized for itself, you can't expect that the owning class is going to do the job for them. It's never happened in history. No slave-owning class... ever freed their slaves, even though one or another slave owner might have freed his or her slaves, but as a group, they can't, because otherwise they wouldn't exist. And
well, what happens is they learn to exist and live on this slave labor instead of developing other methods that could, in fact, be, in the long run, perhaps better off.
They wouldn't be better off. They're better off by where they are. And that's how it works. Inertia keeps you where you are. You don't like where you are, you got to push it over.
Yeah, well, it's the here and now rather than the long term.
Yeah.
And, of course, my first rule is you got to think long term. And I think more successful businesses think long term. But rather than these short term profits, and that's what we're seeing all of these issues now popping up about stock buybacks rather than paying workers, things like that. Because what's happened, of course, is we've had at certain times in the past, during the robber baron age and during the 1920s, you've had this vast spreading of wealth up to the top and leaving behind the overwhelming numbers of middle and lower income people. And the it was overcome a couple of times. One was Teddy Roosevelt. One was under Franklin Roosevelt. But there are no more Roosevelts left in politics.
No, and the specific program of the current right wing is to get rid of what Franklin Roosevelt did 100 years ago, 90 years ago.
Well,
they've been at it for 90 years. No wonder once they got a head of steam up, they got plenty of momentum.
Yeah, and what they do is they try to rewrite history. You know, you have Amity Schles, who's out there saying Hoover was Coolidge were right, not FDR, misinterpreting history. We've talked about it, mentioning the recession of 37 rather than the successes of from 32 to 36 under things. And
also not mentioning that the recession of 37 was based and caused by abandoning what they had been doing between 33 and 36.
Right.
And he had to go right back to that program of 33 to 36 and finally got bailed out by the war, which was a gigantic anti-depression pro-work program.
I mean, unfortunately, wars are always good for employment.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Of course, now we're in a semi-wartime economy trying to produce things to send over to Ukraine. But there we have Russia being, I think, a pretty good example of oligarchy. And worse than oligarchy, of course, it's kleptocracy. And that, of course, has crept into the American system. What we've seen.
Fascist regimes tend to be kleptocratic. I mean, a fascist regime exists to promote private business, and the people in the government who are in this don't see why they shouldn't personally benefit, since they're making sure that all other big businessmen benefit, and so they do. And so it's always the case, like with Putin, that they accumulate enormous wealth, whether in their name, but they get the use of it. That's part of it. Stealing from the state is just part of fascism.
Well, and this is why they want to get rid of rules and regulations, because those are the things that inhibit them. I mean, Steve Bannon is out there, talking about essentially deconstructing the administrative state because,
in the absence of unions,
it's whatever you can get away with.
Whatever you can get away with, exactly. And you'll get away with everything, because now there's nothing that can stop you. The laws are on your side. The enforcement of the laws are on your side. And there's no pressure in the streets. So naturally, you're free, but nobody else is free. The 1% is free, but the 99% is not free. In that situation, politics is no longer electoral.
Yeah, and of course, now you're back to workers of the world unite. All you have to lose is your chains.
Exactly. Front and center and clear.
Yeah, we can't say that. But again, getting back.
Would you say that the Trumpists are the hidden socialist organizers of America?
Well.
No, because you have to have socialist consciousness to be a socialist.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Their intent is not. Right. What the socialistic intent is. Their intent is not to benefit everybody.
Right.
It's to benefit the few. And it'll be interesting. Don't forget, Trump also railed against one of the candidates for governor, Bill McSwain, who was a prosecutor, because he said McSwain didn't fight for him to overturn the election. By the way, Matt Cartwright, one of the Republicans running against Matt Cartwright, Jim Bognet, is out there saying that the election was stolen from us, meaning Trump and him.
Good. Fantastic. That's it for this week.
All right. Well, happy holidays to everybody.
Happy holidays. Don't eat too much on the remaining days of the Seder.
Remember, Monday is Patriots Day. We in Massachusetts, we ought to remember what those guys stood for. They were willing to pledge their fortunes. That was the end of the we pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. And we know right now that there are a lot of people who have no honor.
See you next week.
See you next week.
You've been listening to Forward with Falk. Longtime Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen discuss politics. Join them again next week, same time, same place.